We just finished singing, "At Your Right Hand Are Pleasures Forevermore." Let's remember that as we turn now to Psalm 73. Psalm 73 actually has a bit of bearing, actually quite a bit of bearing on what we're about to read. Just as you know, as we finished off our short Advent series last week, before we return to the book of James, traditionally here in our church, we take a moment to do, a New Year's sermon as we look forward to the coming of the new year, and that's what we're doing today as we look at Psalm 73. We will be returning to the book of James, and as I mentioned, I will be out on Presbytery business next week, so we won't get to it next week, but the week after that. And hopefully we can then conclude that wonderful book. But now we turn to this wonderful psalm, Psalm 73. And before I read it, I had just come across an article just this past week, just in the last few days, long after the sermon had already been prepared. So I thought, can I fit this article in? And I finally realized it's just too good. I have to be able to share at least a portion of this article with you because it speaks so much to what we're going to see here in Psalm 73. It's an article in the Christian Post written by Robin Shoemaker, or Schumacher, who is a Christian apologist. And it's titled, "The Number One Worldview Today is Woody Allen's." And what he says, well, throughout the whole article is excellent, but especially right at the very beginning, really speaks to our world. It really captures what we've been going through these last few years. Robin Shoemaker says, "When filmmaker Woody Allen was publicly exposed in 1992 as having an affair with the adopted daughter of his partner Mia Farrow, Soon Yi Previn, 34 years his junior, his defense was simply, the heart wants what it wants." In quoting a statement made in an 1862 Emily Dickinson letter, Allen perfectly sums up the rationale underpinning today's prevailing secular worldview, which is a deadly combination of post-truth and pragmatism, and driven solely by the adherent's heart wanting what it wants. And so what ends up happening? The heart wants what it wants, so it elevates itself above everyone else, putting others last, thus becoming the quintessential prideful Captain You planet. The heart wants what it wants, so it commits smash and grab, follow home, and brazen what are you going to do about it robberies, taking from others what it hasn't earned. The heart wants what it wants, so it goes to a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic to end the life of a person it finds currently inconvenient. The heart wants what it wants, so it breaks its marriage vows and destroys its family, all for nothing more than a muscle spasm. The heart wants what it wants, so it refuses to work and lives off of others because it bizarrely believes it is entitled to do so. The heart wants what it wants, so it suppresses truth and rewrites history to fit a lying narrative that furthers its agenda and enriches itself. The heart wants what it wants, so it cancels disagreement and slanders others because they threaten its echo chamber's false peace. The heart wants what it wants, so it misuses religion in order to murder, suppress, oppress, and exploit people in hopes of getting the power, position, and wealth that it desires. The heart wants what it wants, so it deliberately thinks with its feelings instead of using the mind and facts to arrive at conclusions that may be distasteful at first, but saving in the end. And he goes on from there. The heart wants what it wants. What an apt description as he describes all the different things that we face in our culture. And the thing is, as we look over, can we use any other word than the insanity of the last couple of years? We walk away and say, these are the folks that are winning. These are the folks who seem to be gaining traction. And what about us who are trying to do the right things? What Psalm 73 is dealing with is the question that every Christian asks at some point, which is, why are these folks prosperous? And these folks are what the Bible refers to as the wicked. And what's behind that question is the calculus that basically says, if you do good, you will be blessed. But if you do evil, you will suffer. But it sure doesn't seem that way. We read that article and we are reminded of what we've been facing as a society these last few years. And it sure seems that it's the upright who are suffering instead of the wicked. And it's the wicked who are prospering instead of the upright. It's that Asaph deals with in Psalm 73. So let's read this wonderful little psalm and see what we can learn and how we can apply it as we enter into 2022. Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death, their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked. Always at ease they increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task, until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. Thus far, the reading of God's word, may he bless it to our hearing, especially as it is preached to us this morning. The people of God, you have to love this author, this writer of this psalm, Asaph. He's so very honest. He's so very transparent with us. He's sharing with us here his spiritual journey. And he's being vulnerable and he's sharing his real struggles as he went through his process of getting to know God and trusting God and relying on God. He tells us in verse 2 that he had gotten to a point where he had almost stumbled, he says, where he had nearly slipped. He had become bewildered at the way that God orders life. He recognized that it was very hard to stay on the narrow path. And while he was doing so, while he was expending all that effort to be good, it seemed like the wicked were just coasting along, that they were doing however and whatever they pleased, and they were the ones who were prospering. And perhaps even as you enter into this new year, you're asking that question. Perhaps you're slipping in your spiritual journey. Perhaps you're wondering, what gain is there in following God? What gain is there in being obedient and faithful when everybody seems to do whatever they want and seem to be getting away with it? Perhaps you too are asking that question. And so that's where this psalm comes in. It has the answers for us as we face this perpetual issue. It wasn't just in Asaph's day, it's as much in our day and is in every age. And as we look at Psalm 73, I want us to see three things that it shows us. It shows us the grand illusion, the grand seduction, and then the grand reality. The grand illusion, the grand seduction, and then the grand reality. Let's begin with the grand illusion. Because when we look at life, it doesn't seem to be like those movies from the early and mid part of the 20th century where the good guys wear white hats, the bad guys wear black hats, and the good guys always win in the end. It's funny, if you like to study and watch movies or study the history of cinema, you'll notice that as we went deeper into the 20th century and postmodernism and despair grabbed our hearts more and more, our movies changed and they became more and more cynical. I just saw a movie with my family yesterday. I won't mention what movie it was because it'll ruin it for you if you do end up watching it. But in the end, all the good guys are dead. Every last one of them. And that seems to be much more in keeping with what we see in reality, because when we look out there, it seems that the real winners in life are those who thumb their nose at God, those who ignore His commands, those who go for whatever they want, wherever they want, and in any way that they want. These are, in some cases, the beautiful people, the ones who are privileged. In some cases, they are the gifted people. Some cases they are the powerful people, but in all things it just seems like they can enjoy all of life's pleasures seemingly at no cost. Meanwhile, you and I struggle. You work hard to make your payments. You don't rely on others to bail you out. You obey the rules. You, while not perfect, resist sin and work hard at trying to follow Jesus. You've taken pains to raise your family biblically, and you try as best as you can to act with integrity. In other words, you try to color inside the lines. And all this with little reward, recognition, or appreciation. And you might say, that's fine, I can live with that. I don't need to be extolled or recognized. But it gets much worse than that, doesn't it? Because even after you do all those things, you can end up like that guy who was always faithful tithing, but in the end, he ended up in financial disaster. How can that be? Or that person who is honest, but gets beat out by the liar and the cheater. It reminds me of the life of my cousin Eddie, who was a faithful man, faithful to God, faithful to his wife, faithful to his family to provide. And yet his wife cheated on him. She left him, and in the end, before he had hit 40, he had died in an accident. Is that what life is all about? Is that where we end up? Is that a successful life? Why live that way? The wicked, on the other hand, according to Asaph, they seem to be carefree. He says in verse 4, "For they have no pangs until death." There doesn't seem to be anything that bothers them. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They can do whatever they want and get away with it, right? They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and they speak with malice. Right? Don't they look down on their average person? Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens and their tongues struts through the earth. These are the folks who can go wherever they please and say whatever they want. They seem to live above the frustrations of life. They disregard God and His commandments. They live at the expense of others. And all throughout, they're scoffing and they're boasting and they're threatening. Perfect example of that was just this past week. Cooper Anderson is he claims to be an activist, but he's a journalist, but he's really an activist on CNN. He comes from a moneyed family. He's the son of Gloria Vanderbilt. And he was interviewing Bill Gates, a man who made his fortune by hard work, by developing a computer operating system that we now call Windows. But all of a sudden, this technology guru is an expert on vaccines and healthcare. And he has taken a lot of interest, Bill Gates has, in having people acquiesce to his particular program for the health of the world. And so here's Cooper Anderson interviewing Bill Gates, discussing what are they going to do about the fact that so many people have not been vaccinated against COVID. And as they wrestle with this dilemma, Cooper Anderson offers a suggestion. What if we deny Social Security benefits to people who are unvaccinated? And as soon as he says it, Bill Gates just begins giggling and laughing. He finds it hilarious. They scoff at us. They mock us. They actually enjoy that level of control. And they do all these things seemingly without consequence. And their success and their prosperity has led them to arrogance. Arrogance towards others, as we saw in that interview. Arrogance towards God. And as we read in the text, in verse 11, how can God know? Is there no knowledge in the Most High? It seems that God just allows it. As the Dutch Reformed theologian wrote, Willem van Gemeren, he once said, for them, life is now, and now seems to be forever. That's the grand illusion. That those who don't follow the rules, those who thumb their nose at God, those whom the Scripture calls the wicked, truly are prosperous. That their lives are lives of ease. And when you believe that grand illusion, it's very easy to become resentful. Because you see that these folks have all the power. They have all the freedom. They can do whatever they want and get away with it. And so the question then becomes, then why should I not be like them? And that leads to our second point, the grand seduction. Once you believe the grand illusion, you're opening yourself up to the grand seduction. And you see that's what Asaph is dealing with here, a crisis of faith in verse 2. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. Again, this man is being awfully transparent for our benefit as we see him wrestling. It was a crisis of faith that was driven, he says, by envy. He's willing to admit it in verse 3. He says, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. You see, people of God, when we believe the grand illusion that the arrogant are blessed, that the wicked will prosper, then we fall for the grand seduction. We look at their prosperity, we look at their success, and we want to be like them. We want to enjoy what they enjoy. Have you never felt that way? Have you never sat there and said, why should they get everything and I don't have any of this? And the reason for that, we're told in verse 10, is because in the end, we worship success as much as anything else. In verse 10, it says, therefore his people, that is God's people, turn back to them and find no fault in them. Now, verse 10, the way the ESV translated it was not as clear. Once you look at it in context, you see that's what it's saying. It's God's people turning back to the successful people and finding no fault in them. I like the way the Revised English Bible makes it a little clearer. It says, so the people follow their lead and find in them nothing blameworthy. Or the Good News Translation says, so that even God's people turn to them and eagerly believe whatever they say. And that's what happens. We get seduced. We want to be like them. We begin to idolize them. We adulate them. And when we do that, we encourage them to continue in their behavior, ever egging them on to new heights of over-the-top behavior and lifestyles. And think of the outrageous behavior in my day, back in the 80s. Guys like Boy George. In the 90s, we had Dennis Rodman. In the 2000s, we have Adam Lambert or Miley Cyrus. As we tell these people, your music is great, your career is great, it just pushes them on to do more and crazy things. Or people who think that they're better than the rest, people like Lori Lightfoot and Nancy Pelosi, who are allowed to do things even as they sit there and say the common folks can't. But we allow them. We celebrate the success, and so it continues on. Or the infidelity of people like Tiger Woods or David Letterman, it cost them nothing to be serial adulterers. Or the perversions of Woody Allen. Was he ever ostracized for doing the evil things that we read about even in that article just a moment ago? You see, we worship their success. In the end, we want to be like them, so they continue on. We approve of their behavior. And why shouldn't they continue in that behavior? Because in the end, you ask, what value is there in godliness? What have we gained? In verse 13, Asaph says, all in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. I've wasted my time, he says. It's gotten me nowhere. In fact, the only place it's gotten me is to a point of suffering. He says in verse 14, for all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. So that's the grand seduction. After we buy into the grand illusion that these are the folks who are truly prosperous, then we get seduced to wanting to be like them and to want to enjoy the success that they enjoy. But the question for us this morning, people of God, is have we really judged the situation correctly? Is this in fact what is really going on? Is what we're seeing so, or is it just an illusion? Let's look again at verse 3 where Asaph says, "For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Did you see that? When I saw. The whole of his assessment is based solely on judging what he sees. It's only a surface appearance. It's an illusion of prosperity. And it's that illusion that has seduced Asaph. Asaph has been seduced by a lie. And because of that, what he tells us in verse 22 is that he's been ignorant of the reality. He says, "When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. I was like an animal," he says, in reference to God. "I could no longer see because my envy, my desire to have what they had, had led me to the point where I could not see the truth." But thankfully, he does see the truth. And we need to see that truth as well. As we go into a new year, where it would seem that cancel culture will continue, where it would seem that those who can do whatever they want, who are better than others and yet do things with no consequence, that will continue. And where you begin to question, then what good is there in my obedience? What good is there in my following God? But we have to be able to see what Asaph sees. And that's the grand reality. You see, in verse 16, after he's described all this and his struggles, and he's been open and transparent and vulnerable with us, we see that Asaph has been engaging in some soul searching. He says in verse 16, "But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task." He's trying to look at it from all angles. It's not making sense. He's looking for answers. And then he tells us in verse 17 that he finally found the answer. But he only found it as he turned to God himself. "But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until..." And there's the turning point in the entire psalm. "Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end." It was when I entered into the sanctuary. Remember, the sanctuary is not necessarily a building, but the sanctuary is the place where God makes himself known. It's the place set apart where God reveals himself and manifests himself. Yes, in the Old Testament days of Asaph, that was in the tabernacle or in the temple. But now, in the new covenant, it is Jesus who is that new temple, the sanctuary of God. He is the Emmanuel, as we've seen over the Christmas season, God with us. And it is only as we enter into the presence of God, he says, that he could finally discern, that he could finally realize what their destiny truly was. Before we look at that, let's just focus on how important it was that he met God in worship. It was not as he turned to God merely as an object of speculation. It was not as just as he thought about God in philosophy or even in theology, but it was when he had entered into the presence of God in his sanctuary in worship that he could see. And that's a very key and important principle for us. As we seek answers in life, the place to do that is to enter into God's presence. To come into his sanctuary, to come to Jesus Christ, the one who reveals God to us. And it is only in the light of God that we will find answers to the big questions of life, to each and every one of them. That's what happened to Asaph. And what was it that he learned? He finally saw the wicked as they truly are. Not the illusion. It was dissipated and he can finally see him as they were. But the key thing to notice is that he could not see them so long as he kept his eyesight down here. The book of Ecclesiastes refers to it when it talks about there is nothing new under the sun. When everything in our perspective is just down here, under the sun, then yes, those wicked folks do look like they're prospering. But when we get the grand perspective, which only comes as we are in God's presence, as God's light shines down, it was only when he saw the wicked in contrast with God, in contrast with God's eternity and his sovereignty and his underived being, in contrast with his beauty and majesty and goodness, it was only when he saw that in God that he could see the wicked for what they truly are. And it was then that their true character was revealed. And as Derek Kidner, that great English Old Testament theologian, said, these were merely men of the moment. That's all they are. They're the flavor of the month. Merely men of the moment. Their prosperity was greatly exaggerated because it's a fleeting prosperity. And so from that point on in the psalm, from verse 18 on, Asaph begins to contrast the true end of the wicked with that of the people of God. And what does he say in verses 17 and following is the end, the destiny of the wicked? He says it is nothing other than judgment. It's nothing other than condemnation. In verse 18, he says, truly, you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. You see, they are in high places, but they will slip. They are lifted up, but they will fall to ruin. Their prosperity is illusory. It is, as he says in verse 20, merely a dream. Merely phantoms. Their end is judgment. But there's something I really want you to see that goes much further. What is that judgment? We tend to think of God's judgment as being hot, fiery wrath. But think about this. What Asaph is about to say is much more chilling than that. Because think about when somebody does something wicked and evil in order to gain notoriety so they can get their 15 minutes of fame on TV. Or those who figure they're after me because I'm so famous or I'm so important that that's why. It's not even the fact that they're on the wrong side of the law. The point is people are paying attention to them because they're so much on the wrong side of the law. And you can almost imagine somebody saying, I'm so important that God has to judge me with so much wrath and hellfire. But what we see here is that God's judgment of their evil is ultimately a personal rejection. And if you want to think of something that's cold, that is about as cold as it gets. In verse 20, he says, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. The word there that despise means that God dismisses them. They enjoyed their prosperity. They enjoyed all their success for a while. But in the end, God dismisses them as of no further account. They are of no more interest to him. The ultimate judgment is that God just turns his shoulder, a cold shoulder to them, and they no longer matter. Daniel 12:2 says that God will regard them with shame and everlasting contempt. And think about what Jesus himself said in Matthew 7:23, when he says that we who rebel against God may very well hear him say, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Think about what that really means. It reminds me of the Irish saying that says, love me if you will, hate me if you must, but for God's sake, don't ignore me. That's the coldest judgment of all. Eliezer Wiesel was a Romanian survivor of the Holocaust, went on to win the Nobel Prize. He once wrote, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And that is the judgment that God brings against the seemingly prosperous wicked. As C.S. Lewis wrote in his famous essay, The Weight of Glory, we can be left utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, finally and unspeakably ignored. And that is the judgment that Asaph lays out here in verses 18 and following. But when you contrast what he says about God's people, we can use C.S. Lewis's words again. He says, on the other hand, we can be called in, welcomed, received, and acknowledged. And that is, in fact, what happens. For God's people, it's not rejection, but it's acceptance. Rather than being ignored, rather than being set out, God accepts us. But even more so, the greatest blessing of God's people, the one thing that the wicked will never have, is that they will enjoy God's presence. That's why we're looking at the sanctuary of God. God's people have the privilege of being able to enter into the presence of God as we approach Jesus Christ. As Asaph says in verse 23, nevertheless, I am continually with you. He's here now quoting God. I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. People of God, when we stand in His presence, it transforms your entire outlook on life. It puts everything in proper perspective. And only then can you see everything the way that it was really meant to be. That's why worship is so important. Worship is not simply a time to learn. It is a time to praise God, to extol Him for who He is. And when we look at Him and when we see Him, then our vision gets corrected. And we can look out into the world with the proper lenses in front of us and see things as they truly are. And what Asaph tells us here is that God is with us every step of the journey. He travels with us. He says in verse 23, nevertheless, I'm continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Derek Kidner called that being grasped, guided, and glorified. We're grasped, you hold me, you hold my right hand. We're guided, you guide me with your counsel. We are glorified, and afterward you will receive me to glory. That is the privilege that nobody on the outside of God's people will ever enjoy. God walking with us every step of the way, holding us hand in hand. And even when we die, that cannot separate us from God. He says in verse 26, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Even after death, we will remain in the presence of God forever. Do you remember in Matthew chapter 22 when Jesus was confronting the Sadducees, talking about the resurrection of the dead, and he said to them, as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was sent to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Notice he did not say, I was the God of Abraham. I was the God of Isaac. I was the God of Jacob. No, I am. Jesus goes on to say, He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Even after you die, nothing will separate you from the presence of God. There is this unbreakable bond. He is the strength of my heart. The word there literally means the rock, the anchor. And as we read what Asaph is telling us, we realize that in the end, no matter what the world has, no matter what the wicked have, no matter what the prosperous have, the one thing that they don't have is the one thing that we're all searching for, which is God Himself. He says in verse 25, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. People of God, God is enough, and we need nothing more. Every single human being, including everyone in this room, we all have this ache that we long to satisfy. And we try filling that void in our lives with so many other things besides God. We seek power and wealth. We look for it in sex or in status or in approval or in comfort. But the one thing we learn is that none of any of those will satisfy. Maybe just for a moment, but then we're left hungering for more. And it never, never fills that void. But as Augustine said in his famous book, The Confessions, you, O God, have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in you. And there's the answer. We pursue and we look for, and all the time we're restless, we're restless, we're restless, until we find our rest in God, because we were made for Him. God, you see, people of God, is the ultimate prize. But the most amazing thing that we have to see as we wrap this up is not that we have God, but that God would have us. That's where we see His grace. In that essay to which I referred earlier, The Weight of Glory, by C.S. Lewis, he says this: "Perhaps it seems rather crude to describe glory as the fact of being noticed by God. But this is almost the language of the New Testament. St. Paul promises to those who love God, not as we should expect that they will know Him, but that they will be known by Him." It is a strange promise. Does not God know all things at all times? But it is dreadfully re-echoed in another passage of the New Testament. There we are warned that it may happen to any one of us to appear at last before the face of God and hear only the appalling words, "I never knew you. Depart from me." In some sense, as dark to the intellect as it is unendurable to the feelings, we can both be banished from the presence of Him who is present everywhere and erased from the knowledge of Him who knows all. We can be left utterly and absolutely outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, finally and unspeakably ignored. On the other hand, we can be called in, welcomed, received, acknowledged. We walk every day on the razor edge between these two incredible possibilities. Apparently, then, our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere neurotic fancy, but the truest index of our real situation. And to be at last summoned inside would be both glory and honor beyond all our merits, and also the healing of that old ache. It is only as we are brought on the inside of that old ache that we all have, what he calls that lifelong nostalgia, can finally be satisfied. It's found in God Himself. So this is the question. How do we get in? For those of us who are on the outside, how do we get inside that door? It's the most important question that every human being has to answer. And C.S. Lewis says in the next few lines, "At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see." But all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. What he's saying is that even as we stand here, we recognize that there's something more. We were made for something more. We see the beauty of the morning. We can see its glory, its majesty. And yet we can't fully grasp it. It slips away from us. How do we get on that other side? And like he says, the whole of the New Testament, the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor, as he says, that it will not always be so. We can get in. And the way that we get in is through Jesus Christ. It is through Jesus that we're brought in, because it is Jesus who, in coming in our place, takes upon himself our sin and our rebellion against God. And because of that, he brings us into a right standing with God. Because of that, we can avoid being rejected and instead become accepted. And not only do we get accepted, but Jesus is the one in this psalm who's traveling with us. Remember, Isaiah 53 said that he is a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. This is a man who knows what you've gone through. This is a man who knows what you're going through right now. This is a man who has suffered what you and I will never suffer, which is the full and unmitigated wrath of God. We talk about Jesus on the cross receiving the wrath of God. What were his words? My God, why have you been angry with me? Why have you forsaken me? Why have you ignored me? Why have you set me aside?" There's the judgment of Asaph. And because Jesus was utterly ignored and forsaken the cross, you and I can be utterly received and accepted and made whole again. That's the promise. And when we understand that grace, then we can say, as Asaph says in verse 1, truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. We're not pure in heart, but Jesus is, and he was in our place. And when we put our trust in him, then his purity becomes ours. And people of God, that changes the whole outlook on life. Why is it that you are good? Why do you obey? Why do you, as we said earlier, color inside the lines? Is not so that you can earn God's favor. You already have it. But it's in gratitude for all that he's done. It's in thankfulness for the grace that he has already shown. So many of us are still operating under that mindset. Do what's good and you will be blessed. Do evil and you will suffer. What we're really saying when we think that way is, I've obeyed you, God, therefore you owe me. That's not the way it works. That's the way of religiosity. That's the way of religion. But the way of grace is not, I will obey, therefore you bless me, but rather, you've blessed me, therefore I obey. And that order is so important. Because you have blessed me and I didn't deserve it, because you were set outside the camp, to use the language of the Old Testament, and you were cut off from your people and cut off from God, now I'm accepted and I'm brought in. And because of that, I obey out of gratitude. You see, people of God, that is the true blessing of God's people. It's what the wicked will never have. And so, as we enter into this new year, recognize that, yes, it would sure seem that there are people now in control who can do whatever they want, and they seem to be getting away with it left and right. But do not be envious. Do not long to be like them. Because they are, as Derek Kidner said, mere men of the moment. And their time is passing. You have something that they do not have. You have the very presence of God. You can come to this Jesus Christ who has brought you to himself. And because of him, you're now accepted. You're now family. And that's why you obey. It's all out of gratitude for what he's done. You have the greatest gift of all. You have that gift, as Asaph says in verse 28, of being near to God. May God enable every single one of us as we go into the year to recognize that all those things that we see and that we can be envious of, in the end, it's all for naught. But if we will simply turn to God, we will find that indeed we will find our rest in him, and you'll find that he will heal that old ache and that he is indeed enough. Let us pray.